Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Prep Talk podcast hosted by myself, Pete Flips, and Nick Spizak. Today, we welcome on a very special guest, Saul at Saul Sells Stuff. He's the king of A to A flips and perhaps our first repeat guest. So welcome, Saul. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, guys. So you nailed that. I think that was perfect.
For the audience, I've had a streak of messing up the intro, but we've broken it, and now my deepest, darkest secrets are on the internet. Saul, you are a repeat guest. For folks that are tuning in for the first time, can you give a little bit of a background about who you are, how you start on Amazon, that sort of thing?
Sure. I'm Saul. I'm 31 years old. I don't know. I feel like age matters in Amazon for some reason. I started selling on Amazon like 8 years ago. So this is 2016? I know 2016, early 2017. Started like everyone else in books. Worked a corporate job, which I didn't love, working like 50 hours a week, managing a bunch of people, super stressed, super unhappy, very like one-dimensional, one paycheck. If you lose it, your life kind of sucks. So I just wanted to branch out, started selling on Amazon. And then as Pete mentioned, A2A, I'm not going to give myself a label. I appreciate the label, but there's certainly people out there that did it more than me. But I started A2A flipping in 2018. It's not the only thing I do. For those that don't know, A2A is buying from Amazon, selling back on Amazon for a profit. Sounds funny when you say it out loud, but it works. And so I've been doing that. It's probably the majority of my Amazon journey for the better part of 5 years. Outside of Amazon, I have my hand in a ton of other stuff. So part owner in like a D2C consumer brand, do a bunch of tech, which I'm excited we probably will get to today. You know, I try to keep myself busy and I still get bored. So I'm sure there's more that's going to happen in my life.
Yeah, Saul. So you just wrapped up. We just saw in there you wrapped up the A2A challenge. So how did that go? Like, what were some of the goals and expectations you had? And just kind of give us a rundown of it.
Yeah. So for those that aren't familiar, the A2A challenge was a 5-day like A2A boot camp, if you will. The challenge series kind of originated through Chris Grant with the OA challenge. Then he did the wholesale challenge with Corey. And then now we're doing the A2A challenge. And I've mainly, I think 80% of my Twitter feed is me just trying to teach people A2A best I can through text, which can be tricky. And I have a Discord. And so in there, I can post some videos and I can do some live calls. But A2A at its core it's simple, but every situation is slightly nuanced. And when you look at a chart for OA and RA, there's similarities, but A2A can also have its own like specifics. And so the challenge really allowed me to dive super deep into things that I just can't do on Twitter. And so we went live Monday through Friday, 3 hours a night, pretty much. And it was about an hour and a half, 2 hours of me just going over a category each night, and then like an hour, hour and a half of questions. And dude, I was so nervous. I was leading up to it. I was talking to Chris and he's like, listen, just don't throw up and you'll be fine. And he's like, Chris is like, my job is to make sure that you don't back out. Like that was like his whole job in the challenge. And I didn't think I ever would, but you should ask my wife, but I was pacing. I don't know if I was sweaty, but like I was certainly for like 2 weeks heading into it. I just didn't want to let people down. I think I'll be very obviously transparent. There was a cost involved. Like people had to pay to do it. And so when you're accepting money, there's just like this extra. Twitter is one thing. I can tweet all day and be like, well, it's free. And so like, that's a typo, or like, this thing isn't exactly right. That's fine. Like when someone's giving you money, you want to over deliver. And that was probably the most nerve wracking part. But I ended up with like 10 or 12 pages of notes in my notebook. After the first day, it was so much easier. Like that first day jitters, they were gone. And the feedback was, yeah, it was better than I thought it was going to be. So I was super proud.
Talk about the nerves of teaching a little bit, like two aspects of it. Like why were there nerves? Do you think as you go through and do more iterations of A2A challenge or other type of trainings, those will be things that you'll always have? Or is it something that you kind of with practice, you kind of get better with it as you go?
Second part is hard to say because I've only done one. I mean, I think I've been fortunate that through Amazon and through helping people on Amazon the last 4 or 5 years, I've gotten live in front of hundreds of people and been able to quote unquote teach. Like the idea of going live and talking about something is not foreign. But I think the idea of going live when you're the only person on the screen, that is like kind of terrifying. For like 2+ hours, you're like, okay, I'm just talking to the camera for 2 hours. Like no one can talk back to me. And that's like, that's scary. I do think it'll get better. I also like to think that I maybe did more than I did more than I thought I was going to, because I was so concerned about not delivering. So I like went all kind of above and beyond. And so now the next one, I know kind of where to cut back. Like, okay, maybe that was some filler stuff and I can like remove that. But I'm positive I'll be nervous. I'm going to out Chris here. Chris has done 11 OA challenges and he told me like he's nervous every time. Like I think there is like something about clicking record that first day that's just like always going to be nerve wracking. But the teaching part's super cool. I think the second part I was nervous about, you know, I do spend a lot of money doing A2A and I do it a lot, but I will be the first to say there's certainly people out there that do it more than me. And what if one of them showed up? Like there's always this thing of like, there's a great book and I don't remember the name, but you know, every time someone goes on stage and talks, there's always the chance that someone in the audience knows more than them about whatever topic they're going to talk on. And like, how do you react to that? And I was pretty confident there will be people in this audience that like do this at the same level I do. And what are they going to get out of it? And like, honestly, those are the people I was almost focused on a little bit that first day, because I wanted validation. And so there were a couple that were in the chat and I knew their names and I knew of them and they were like, oh, I've already learned something. And that just like the waves.
There
just,
you go.
Yeah, I was so happy. And, like, I was so elated to hear that, because I'm happy to admit that I don't know everything. But at the same time, I don't want to have a room full of people and by the end of it, they're like, oh, I've learned nothing new. So, you know, but thankfully there's always nuance and I think there's always something to learn from everyone. And that's how people came into it.
Well, and one thing, like I've done a little bit of 8A now, mostly learning from you and some of the resources that you have. And one thing that I learned through 8A that I didn't realize prior to 8A is how incomplete sometimes Keepa data is. Could you touch like a little bit on that and your experience and just shit kind of open up that can of worms, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love like a follow-up context, but I mean, I can talk about what I think that means, and then maybe if you have an example or something that you're thinking.
Yeah, so like specifically for me, like looking at it and kind of seeing when Amazon is in or out of stock, like sometimes it's a little bit blurry. You'll see like no in stock, and they'll be repeatedly, you know, delivering product. But any other nuances that you're aware of might be helpful to the audience as well.
Yeah, I think A2A has opened up my sourcing opportunities OA and RA in certain charts, because, and you guys probably have seen this, when you do OA, I think that's what you're both of you mainly do. You'll see like Amazon is historically at $100 and then randomly they go up to 200 and they actually increase the price for really no good reason. Retail is $100, but for some reason they just decided to sell for super high. You can take advantage of that. Like those are things that I would have historically been afraid of, but A2A has taught me that you don't have to be. 60% of my listings I compete with Amazon on. I'm very open about that. I've done very well doing that. And part of it is you find listings where Amazon, is like going up and down in price. You can just sell at the high and wait out the lows. And a lot of people see the lows and that's like the benchmark they use. But if there's a pattern of price up and downs, it should totally go for that. Also, you know, there's the idea that Amazon's in stock 70% of the time, they're out of stock 30% of the time. Maybe that's something I don't want to tackle. People usually wait for Amazon to be out of stock. Like, oh, Amazon's out of stock. The price has gone up and now I'm going to purchase. And the reality is like you wanted your inventory into Amazon when they went out of stock. You don't want to be buying when they're out of stock. And so if you can, you know, quote unquote, time the market, but really it's just looking at historicals and be like, well, they usually go out of stock every 3 months and I'll just buy enough to support that, or I'll wait, or I think that pattern looks like it's coming up again. All like different little nuances, I think, that aren't specific to A2A, but looking at charts through the lens of A2A forces you to confront them. Then you take that into your other sourcing. And I've certainly become a better sourcer elsewhere because of A2A. But I don't want people listening to think it's all that kind of, it's not all that confusing. Like those charts are great and you can make a ton of money. They're not all like that. if you're listening, you're like, oh, A2A sounds like super risky. Yeah, I mean, it's no different than sourcing whether Kohl's or wherever else you source, you still have to look at the data and you still have to buy it and ideally arbitrage the difference. But you learn that you can kind of play in the sandbox a little bit differently than maybe you thought you could. And things that aren't as risky as they might seem. I think that's probably the biggest takeaway from some of those charts.
Yeah, one thing that I noticed in kind of in my 8A experience, just going like basically learning a new thing is going like fives, tens, widening that catalog, and then understanding how those different charts react once you're playing with them. It's been really, really beneficial. Like, so I think if you're going to start 8A, just start it small. Like you started maybe what probably most folks are doing for online arbitrage, which would be like, you know, larger websites, where that's where a lot of people start. Just do it the same way, just fives, tens, and then increment as you go. That's been my experience and it's gone really well.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, wide, not deep. I know that I feel like lately there's been some murmur, you should go deep, not wide. I mean, I still think early on in anything, like wide, not deep is not a bad play. Especially if your nerves are like analysis paralysis is real. So like sometimes you just have to click the button.
So down the 8A rabbit hole a little bit more here. So a lot of focus around account health and ways to mitigate it. Would you recommend 8A as an option for new sellers, or do you still see the traditional RA, OA, and those types of models being the entry points for newer sellers before getting into an 8A model?
I don't think A2A has to have like, I don't think you have to validate anything prior to A2A, but I do think it's going to follow the same, like, do you have more time or more money kind of idea, which is something that we kind of hear early on. Like generally, if you have more time, then you can gravitate more towards like the online model, which is going to be OA, A2A, like just buying things in line because your margin ROI be a little bit lower, but you have If you have more time, you're going to go into RA. More time is RA because you have the time that you can spend in the store. And that's where the higher margin, higher ROI is. If you have more money than time, that's where you're going to go online because you can buy things faster, but you're not as concerned about your cash flow. Yeah. There's no hesitation in my mind. Like if you're a brand new seller and you are going to start doing OA, I think you can certainly start doing A2A at the same time. I do want to be very careful though, like, and I think we'd all agree, like, it's not ever one or the other, right? Like, you could do all of them. And I really think that there's a nice little hybrid that happens, especially with A2A and OA, because, and we go over this extensively, and probably people listening have read my tweets, like, this is going to sound like the 17th time they've heard this, but like, if you do A2A effectively, half the time, you're going to end up finding products OA that you A2A, like you're just going to like reverse engineer where Amazon's matching. And that's probably most of my OA now. Like I don't really do a whole lot of newsletters or like sale sites and things. I'm really just following the breadcrumbs that Amazon leads me to these OA sites. It's nice. It's a little bit nice to do them in tandem, especially if you feel like you're a little lost in the sea of OA and you don't know what store to start at. It's cool if you can match an A2A sale and be like, all right, well, this is at least I have one thing on this page that's profitable. Let me go like look and see what else is.
One thing that we should probably mention if like somebody's just hearing about 8A for the first time. Saul, could you talk a little bit about the right way to do 8A in terms of not violating terms of service?
Oh yeah, yeah. 100 accounts, FOMO, like just like go all in everywhere. It's pretty simple. So you are going to want to, I mean, I'm just going to lay it out. Generally, you want two accounts, not because you're getting around TOS or anything, just makes your life a little easier. You're going to want a business account and a personal account. Neither of them are going to have Prime. You take nothing away from this call. So you're not going to buy Amazon A2A flips with Prime shipping. You're going to hear a bunch of people that say, oh, I do it all the time. I've done it for years. No problem. And like, that's fine. I say fine because they're aware of the risk. My job and our job is to make people aware of the rules. If you decide to go around the rules, that's a decision you're making, but I will never sit here and tell you to break the rules knowingly. I'm not gonna be like, hey, screw the rules, do this. So it's against TOS to use Prime shipping when reselling technically anywhere. That includes eBay, et cetera, but like Amazon's probably really gonna catch you more than anywhere else. And we have both accounts because some things you can only buy on a personal account and sometimes you get better pricing on a business account. So it's just nice to have both, but you don't want to buy the same thing on both. So you can't like get around quantity limits by buying three things on your personal and six things on your business. Those are like the two big no's. Otherwise, treat it like you would any other OA account. Like we talked about Kohl's. Like if you're going to go make a Kohl's account, you're going to use your real name and your email and your address because you want that invoice or receipt to match up in case you need to submit it. Same thing here. Like you should be using all of your legitimate information. Big question I get all the time is like, well, can I use that same email that's on my seller account to do A2A on my buy account? Like, reality is like, yeah, like you certainly can. Like you all don't have to. If you want to make a separate Amazon account, you can do that too. But I try to remind people that Amazon is a tech company. Like at their core, they are a tech company. And so if you think just by making one other account, you're going to like confuse them, like they're gonna be like, oh, Saul over here is not the Saul over here. Like, no, like they're going to know. So yeah, you could certainly separate it just for like your own like ease and organization. There's nothing wrong with A2A, but don't think by creating a second account with a different email address, suddenly you can go break the rules and they're not going to like attach it to your seller account. Like, they will certainly find a way to figure out who you are. So you just play in the sandbox and, I mean, plenty of money if you play by the rules. Like, you don't need to go around. I value my seller account. I value all the listeners' seller accounts. So like, you should value them too.
Now, just to add a little bit more to it, right? So we talked a little bit about A to A. I also saw that there was a thread on the timeline today around A to W, so Amazon to Walmart. You want to talk a little bit about that? How does that play into your business, and what are some ways to use that as an effective strategy?
Yeah, I mean, personally, at the time of recording this, right, we're in mid-June, I have a Walmart account. I'm not a very active Walmart seller. It's just a time issue for me. Most of my Walmart buying has been RA, and I just haven't had time to like learn that process yet of shipping it in. Fortunately, I have some amazing people in my life but both do Walmart and also help me with Walmart. And so I do a lot of the sourcing part. Like, I understand the process of sourcing. I love the sourcing for Walmart. I hate the shipping for Walmart. So Amazon to Walmart is just like another cool avenue for A2A flips that don't meet your A2A like model. Like, there's, as we know, Amazon has tons of brands that are gated, or even just like sometimes you think something's really good, but it's just not quite as profitable as you want it to be. Walmart's Amazon 7 years ago, right? Like, it's just the Wild West a little bit. And there's some crazy brands that are super open on Walmart, like Levi and LOL dolls. Like, that blows my mind. It's like giving me shivers when I think about selling LOL dolls on Amazon. I'd be like, that's an extra $1 million a year if I could just sell that one brand. But you can sell them at Walmart. So if you come across these great, great deals, it behooves you. The SAT word, right? Like, go out and look and see if they're profitable at Walmart. Because if they are, like, you're already doing the work. You've already found the product. Why not buy it and sell it on the other marketplace? Nick, I know you have something in your space too that's going to help some sellers, ATW. I think that's like a cool model that's, you know, we've been playing around with for at least a few months now. And I think, yeah, not only is Walmart the Wild West of selling, but it's also the Wild West of tech. Like, there's just like very little for Walmart sellers out there. So if we can do anything, you know, to help them, that's great. I have a warehouse. I have a corner of my warehouse that's dedicated to Walmart that's just like growing and staring at me every day. And like, it's kind of a problem. And so I have one of my good friends who I work with, the Buy Box, which is our Discord server. Like, he's actually flying in, not this weekend, the weekend after, just to help me like move my shipments out. Like, I got to the point where I was like, I can't do, I just can't, I need help. I just DM him, like, please help me. So sometimes you get asked for help regardless of who you are. But I think Walmart's really cool, and I think that's going to be a nice opportunity. And I mean, yeah, we'll see. Maybe we'll check in next time I'm here, and we'll see how Walmart's going.
In your defense, I have also played around with the Walmart like Seller Central, and it is extremely ugly right now. It'll improve. It'll get better. Yeah. I've been pretty confused by it so far. We're spoiled on the Amazon space. For sure. Transitioning the conversation a little bit, we have two resident software aficionados in the house. I'm not one of them. So can we talk a little bit about software in terms of like how you got started with it, why you're interested in it, and then maybe we'll dive into a couple of the examples that you've worked on?
Sure. I would like to, I'm going to correct you. So there's one. I mean, really, it's Nick. Like I hire really smart people and I work with them. Nick is like the smart person. So there's one like aficionado developer. There's one guy who just like likes to be around it. And like, I'm the guy who likes to be around it. Taking it back a second, back to A2A, you know, we started a Discord in 2019 dedicated to seller support for Amazon called the Buy Box. And that was really fun and it's still going on. And I would almost call it a passion project at this point because it certainly doesn't like, I spend just as much time there as I do anywhere else in the world. But that allowed me, because it was Discord based, allowed me to like ask people like, hey, like, can we build some stuff to help me? Like everything I do is kind of selfishly to help me. And then if it helps me, I figure it'll help other people. And so we built some A2A tech that I was sitting there for hours just like on Keepa and other places like trying to find deals. And it's like, we have to find something better than this. So we built some stuff that helps just deals come to us. And that was really cool. And then Keepa tracking was kind of like slow and clunky. So we built a solution to that and we have our own tracking software. And then, you know, partnered with Chris Grant, and there was a long time ago, there was Storefront Stocking and he was like at the forefront of it 8-9 years ago. And then it kind of resurged and we're like, oh, let's automate it now. And so we built Storefront Stocking Pro. And so it's always things that just make life easier and more organized and that we use on a daily basis. I try to be the dumbest person in the room, and I've like fulfilled that most of my life at this point. Like I get to work with some awesome people, and I think almost every project that we start is like a different developer, which is also kind of cool because they can all work at the same time. It's not like I'm pulling someone off one team to do something. So like all those projects are like actively being worked on and upgraded. I want to say that just like, they're just so, they're just fun. I think tech is like my means to the end. It's I love the Discord stuff. I love the support stuff. I love the A2A challenge. But the idea of like being able to do all those things in mass and like bring it to like more and more people in volume, and that's like gets me excited. I think all gets me excited, but that's in particular. So the current stuff is called, the number one is called Flip Alert, which is like our generation 2 A2A software. It's been in beta for 4 months. With about 400 users, and it's going live, I think, about 2 weeks. That's the goal, like July 1st-ish. As kind of Nick said on my timeline, I've been tinkering with some Walmart stuff. Like, it's certainly not my forte. Like, I met this super, super smart guy like a week ago through an introduction, and I was just like, all right, let's do something together. And so I've just been throwing him ideas, and he's just been building stuff. And like, that's kind of what happens in my world. And so he's building, some Walmart stuff. And then Storefront Stocker Pro, we've just upgraded. We've just lowered prices on. We're building Walmart into that. So like that's, you know, Storefront Stocker Pro allows you to track sellers and automate kind of, hey, what is their store doing? I'm going to give that information and get all the data. So you don't have to like go to Keepa and do it manually. And right now it's just kind of Amazon related, but we're adding a bunch of Walmart data in there too. So you can see like if Nick adds something to the store, I can see it, and I can also be like, oh, is it profitable in Walmart at the same time? So maybe like Nick isn't thinking Walmart, but I am. And so I'm going to go potentially arbitrage wherever he's buying it from and sell it for more money. So that's what's actually going on. But again, I'm confident in the next 6 months there'll be new things because there's always something new. That's, but I want to, this is a one, it's not one-sided. Like, I don't know if what you guys are willing to share, but like you guys do some cool stuff. Like I'd love to hear what you're doing.
Yeah, we can definitely get in there. You threw out something that you're not a software software guru, but I think we got to set the record straight here. There, it's extremely useful to be a systems thinker, right? And you've demonstrate that ability to be able to take, all right, I have a problem or I see something that I want to make more efficient or more effective on there, and you've worked with, you know, whether that's developers to be able to communicate the requirements that they have to solve the problem. And that's such an effective skill. So for listeners out of there, if you have an idea or you have something that you're thinking about your own businesses, and you're looking into, hey, is there a software, a way that I can make it more efficient? Use that mindset, right? Like being able to think through the problem and all the steps that go into it. You don't necessarily need to write the code as long as you're able to articulate what the problem is and how to solve it. And so I think that's a testament to, you know, how you've gone through. Yes, you're not writing particularly the line of code, but that's systems thinking at its finest. So I wanna kind of pull back the covers a little bit on that. As you're developing each one, what were some of the things that you've learned as you've gone through that journey? And, you know, what, like, that's not something that just, you know, one day you're like, hey, I'm gonna go write software, and you put something out that people love, they use it, they're willing to pay for it. Like, take us through that journey.
Yeah, well, that was so well put. It made me feel really good. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, I've gotten way better at writing like requirement docs. When I first started, we still work with this team, but we work with the team in Europe. And I think there's two, I didn't know what I know now about development. And then there's a slight language barrier, and you add those two things together and you get some very interesting end results. And so I spent lots of money and lots of hours on things I didn't actually want because they thought I wanted them, but I wanted something different. And so you get pretty good at writing your thoughts down, as you said, in a very specific way, in like a point A to point B, like, this is the end result, here's what it should do. And like kind of in like a priority order. So like, you kind of have to think ahead, like, all right, I want it ultimately to do this thing, but in order for it to that thing, I'm going to build this. But if I build this today, maybe sometime in the future, I want it to do something else. I have to build it in such a way that's adaptable so that it can be moved. And I've learned that. And I've learned that through just communicating with these people, because, you know, you run into these problems. You're like, well, how could this not have been a problem? And then you go through and you try to problem solve it that way. I've also learned to kind of the opposite end. I think some developers don't give themselves enough credit for like strategic thinking. I think a lot of people I end up on a phone call with that want to develop with me, like, great. And they're like, all right, give me your idea. And I talk it through and they're like, okay, well, how do you want it done? I'm like, well, I don't try to lead them to that water. Like, I'm like, this is the result. You walk me through like logically, like, forget that we're building an Amazon software. Like the other day, like, peel back, or like, we're connecting an API to do this thing, to do that. Like, how do you think is the most convenient way to do that? And honestly, like, a good chunk of the features are from people that have never sold Amazon. They're just like, you know what would be kind of cool? If, like, I understand what you're trying to build. Like, what if it could do this? And I'm like, that's awesome, because I think a superpower is ignorance. Like, 100%. Like, sometimes when you're too into something, like, you cannot see it anymore for what it is. And so I think both kind of, to mimic what you said, I think both sides have to come in with a very open mind and learning and be willing to like talk about things maybe they're not as used to or comfortable with. Like, I've learned a lot about developer talk without having to write code. I understand a lot of the language now, and like the conversational language, and that's helped me. And in turn, I try to teach whoever I'm working with kind of what the end result here is for the user, so that they can start thinking strategically about features, even if they don't actively sell, because a lot of like really great stuff comes from that. And then last point would just be like setting timelines, setting like goals and timelines and check-ins. Super important. It can be a little fuzzy. I think we have four different development teams now. And so it's some of them work a lot. And I'm meeting with them every day. And then I have some I talk to like once every quarter, because like they just kind of know what to do and I don't need to check in with them as much. But at the beginning stages, it's a lot of like communicating without getting in their way. Cause I don't want to ever get in someone's way. I would say the last thing personally is like, if you're going to partner with a developer, like anyone listening to this, if you want to go build something cool, I've done it both ways now. I've paid people money and I've given them money plus like percentages. I've always found like giving people like partnership agreements is a really nice thing to do. Like, I think that like they're full buy-in. Like, obviously you got to do your research and vet them and like have conversations before that. But I own like a minority stake in most of these software things. They actually, two of them, a majority stake is the developers. Like, I want them to have so much buy-in, because at the end of, like, I can't, one guy's put in well over 1,000 hours and gotten very little money for it because he's in it for the long haul of like, okay, well, this thing will eventually build and, you know, hopefully we have users. That would be difficult if I was just paying him, you know, straight hourly, and he believes in what we're doing. So that was a lot, but yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's more, but it's not coming to mind.
Well, you're demonstrating some very strong skills as like a product owner of like going to the pro, you have a problem you're trying to solve, but you don't necessarily have to dictate how to solve it. And like leveraging that, those team members and partners is a skill that I think most may be a little bit unfamiliar with. So that's really great to hear. But do we want to dive a little bit into each software that you have in a little bit more detail, kind of like the functionality, the problems that you were trying to solve? I mean, we touched on it lightly, but do we want to kind of go through the list, the laundry list of them?
That's up to you. As I said, like, I'm open. I'd love to hear also, like, Nick or Pete, like, if you guys,
He's itching for the spiel.
Like, I don't know how I don't think it's a secret because you said it on Twitter. So like, both are involved in a tech project, and like, that's cool. And we've never talked about it publicly here or offline. And so I'm going to selfishly use this time to do that too. Like, I want to know your experience, the two of you, on that. And if it's your, I don't know your background. I know Nick, a little bit of Nick's background in tech, just from like what you've posted online. But I don't know if this is your first Amazon project that you guys are working on. I talked to your other partner 2 hours yesterday, and he was awesome and said wonderful things about y'all. So like, give me like the 2 minutes. I don't even fully understand exactly what it is. So use this time to teach me.
Analytical shopping, right? So it's a way that we're looking at Linkscopic is community driven from that aspect, right? There's plenty of different software that have been around in terms of product research. There's very few that have taken an angle where, hey, let's build the product with the community in mind. So this is something I've learned through the years doing software development, where you focus on building the product first, and you have this grand idea of thinking, if I build it, they will come. Now, the reverse of that is you take the idea, you take the first version of it, you put it out into the wild, and you start building off of the features for that, right? So creating the demand, creating the feature set that customers actually want. So that's the lens that we're looking to take from this. So it's two-part. It has a web application, and then it also has a Chrome extension. So the way that those are set up now is there's two different tiers. The majority of the product is entirely free right now. So it's set up in such a way that you have the products that you buy. So think of it in customer language, what to buy, where to sell. So we kind of talked about the angle of Amazon and Walmart, how to save. So coupons, cashback items there. And then the fourth tier is around inventory stock. So how much of a particular item can I get when I get it there? So that's kind of the vision that we're thinking of it. But honestly, the direction that we'd like a lot of these things to go is there's a lot of smart people, especially in the Amazon and the e-commerce space, that are doing software projects and a lot of opportunity to partnerships, right? So if we're building something that we have capabilities that can extend into other aspects of the business that provides value, that's ultimately the direction that we're looking to go. So there's mutual benefit on this for this type of call, right? Where we're asking you questions like, what are the types of ideas and the things that are there? And it's the same thing on the other side, right? We're trying to see, okay, if we're in a niche of product research, what are all the other things that can be tied together to give customers the really answer three different questions, right? How do I become more efficient in my business, make more money? How do I become more effective, find products, more efficient, save money, or make the experience better? And those are really the three levers: effectiveness, efficiency, and customer experience.
I'm sold. All right. Who do I write the check to? Really, that was like I've done my fair share of investor pitching, and I feel like you nailed the final slide of the deck. Like, that was great.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're kind of winging it, and that's the behind the curtains view of it, right? This is the first time that a lot of us are starting to think of that lens. Like, we're talking about Chrome extensions, like what goes into not only writing a Chrome extension and try to make it usable, but the process of getting it approved on the Chrome Web Store. Like, when you're talking about product research, how do you do things ethically and making sure that you have all of the items accounted for? So there's a lot that goes into that. And that is literally what we're thinking about is, hey, what's the best way to do this? And are we building, like you talked about it with the 8A challenge, right? The first time you turn the camera on and you're teaching for the first time, are you providing something that's of value? I think that's the same kind of area where we're looking at this also is, hey, is this something that's going to be valuable for the rest of the community to enjoy?
Yeah.
And then selfishly, if you would like to beta test Link's Goblet, hit the DMs.
Yeah, no, I will. It's been in my, yeah, it's on me. I mean, it's been in my DMs for 2 months and I kind of forgot about it.
And the whole squad, anyone that's listening is welcome.
Anyone listening. Oh yes. Sorry. Yes. We should all do that.
Everybody is welcome. We're looking for too. Feedback. So, and I think that that's super valuable and something that we really need is just to make this community driven. Like, there's so many ideas that you could do, like just having somebody like to come in with a fresh set of eyes that isn't kind of in the weeds could provide. So beta testers are absolutely like extremely valuable. So we've spilled the beans. Saul. Now,
I mean, sure.
Do you want to touch a little bit on each of your software, like kind of a little bit of the journey that went into it, some of the struggles, some of the pain points,
individual
projects?
I do think you touched on something though that will come up in one of mine, which I don't know how many beta tests you have and like where you are in that process, but if it's new, if it's early, and you might have some experience with other projects you've done, it's a whole other set of skills, which is, and I hope no one listening takes this the wrong way, but I have learned over through software, but all through like D2C brands, people don't generally know what they want. Like, people think they know what they want, but they don't really know what they want. And I'm a person, so that I fall into that too. And so like, there's this real skill with like weeding through feedback and be like, okay, is this feedback that is going to better the product for everyone? Or is this something that's going to help like 1% of the people? And maybe it's still worth doing, but we have to acknowledge that. And if we say yes to something, we're always saying no to something else. So like, there's this whole like factor there. And that's like its own can of worms when it comes to like the direction of a project goes, which I think is very fun. And I'm excited for you guys and to see obviously where that continues. So yeah, we certainly can. So I talked about it a little bit. In 2020, we launched our very first tool of any kind, and we honestly don't even really have a good name for it. We came up with a bunch of names, but it was never for sale publicly, so we never really felt like we needed to. We built it specifically for the buy box, so it was just for us and for our members. And we can call it Replan Alert. We can call it, like, I think at one point we wanted to call it Komodo. I don't know. We can call it whatever you want, but it was version one of this A2A tool. And so this didn't do any kind of get me kind of, you talked about it. Like, one of the elements is like finding the deals and having them come to you. This didn't really do any of that. The whole purpose of this tool was to be a better keep a tracker. It was, how do we get people, like allow people to input ASINs or products in Amazon and get feedback when they've restocked by specific sellers for a specific price. Faster than Keepa, faster than anyone else, and privately. That was like a huge thing, because at that point in time, Discord groups were like, they existed, but they were mostly cook groups, and a lot of them were like, oh, well, we have Amazon monitors, but like, everyone's gonna see everything that stocks. Like, there's really like, you can recommend something. So we wanted something where people could upload their own product and only they would ever see if it restocked. And so to do that, we had to build a web app. And then we connect that to Discord. And so when things restocked, it notified them on their computer, but it also pinged them on Discord in a DM. And they were, it was entirely up to them to see and manage. And that was also the first time I had to realize you know, how much it costs, like how much data costs and storage costs and like scale, like, all right, well, what is the cost? How much am I paying per user to use this thing? Because again, we weren't charging any money for it. So like at some point I needed to make sure like we weren't losing any money either. I was fine not making any, but like there had to be a middle ground. And so you start small, like we let people like do 100 items and then 200 items. And we got better and the software grew and like now people can do up to 10,000 items and like, it's fine. And so that was a lot of fun. It was a huge learning curve because it cost us an exorbitant amount of money, I'd be honest. Like, I think if I did it now, it would cost a fraction of what it cost then. Like it was like, yeah, it was a brand new car and it still runs and exists today and people still use it because like, I didn't want to retire it necessarily and maybe one day I will. But it was more like just like, again, something to learn off of. And so then after that, it came like, well, to your guys' point, like I have this knowledge, I have this team. What else can we build? Who can I partner with? Like, who has ideas? What can we do? And I don't know what order. I think we were working on Footballer and Stover Stalker Pro at the same time. So Stover Stalker Pro, as I mentioned, is like a Chris Grant, Nate McAllister brainchild. And they had owned it, and then they had kind of put it to rest because it wasn't automated and software was coming out that didn't necessarily like – it didn't make it obsolete – but they had other things they want to focus on and they didn't want to kind of like continue to pay for new development on that particular project at that particular time. And so we partnered with them and said, well, listen, we love the name and we love you guys. And then we'll develop it. So like, that's like a perk of partnership. Sometimes like some people have an idea and you have the team and that's where that comes together. So that was a different development team. And something I want to talk about also is every developer I've ever worked with has been a referral. Like, I've never gone out and posted a job listing or like actively seek people out. It's more like, for example, if we end up doing something together, this is exactly how it would start, right? It would just be like, oh, I met Nick through Pete, and now all three of us get to do something because we had an introduction. And that's all of this ever was. Three of the five, I think there's actually five, three to five were Twitter. So like, shout out Twitter for like existing. And so Stover Stalker Pro was built. And that also had a beta period. Like, I love beta periods. And I think having a built-in community is great. The buy box has really helped because we have beta testers built in. Like, they want to help us. So they're more than happy to try out new products. So that one, as you mentioned, that goes, you upload a user's profile, an Amazon seller's profile, any market, you know, US, Canada, wherever you want. And we'll about every 4 hours, we'll go and pull in all the new ASINs that they have added to their store. And there's a bunch of companies that do this. Like, I don't think we're first to most of these things. A bunch of companies that do this, but a lot of them are Discord based. And so we wanted something that didn't rely on Discord. There's a whole world out there outside of Twitter and Discord. And like, those are the people that I love. Like, those are the customers that I think get ignored. Like, Facebook, shout out to anyone out here that's listening that develops tools. Like, if you want more customers, dude, Facebook groups are where it's at. So Facebook, like, they have no idea what monitors are. Like, they don't, like, they, like, they're like, if you take an Amazon seller that's in like a random Facebook group and one that's in a random like Twitter Discord, like, worlds apart in form of like tech. They know tech arbitrage. That's like their knowledge base. So we didn't want them to have to use Discord. So we built everything into a web app. So like, as product come in, it essentially rebuilds Keepa for you. And so it shows you like the average price. We also are partnered with Chris, so we have access to IP alert. So like, all those products that come in will tell you like if there's IP issues. You know, we like kind of try to make it super simple and super easy for them never to have to leave the app. You know, speaking of partnerships, what we're missing is when products come in, like where to buy them. So like, we have like the Google image search and we have the like clicks and buttons, and we are going to hook it up to Google Shopping. We have the API for that. Like, that'll exist. But we're not going to do like the analytical stuff like you guys are doing, where it's actually like matching UPCs. It's like probably not going to happen. So that if I wanted that to occur, it would have to be a partnership with like someone that's already doing that. And so that's that's Server Snogger Pro. I think it's really cool. And we just launched a $15 tier plan. So like $15 a month. Because again, at the end of the day, like no one's here to get rich. Like it's just helping people and make it easier and make life a little bit like time wise, make it a little bit less struggling to have to click a bunch of buttons. And then Flip Alert, we talked about that. And that is the one that's launching, yeah, like 2 weeks. And that's taking our replan alert and putting steroids. So instead of just allowing you to like monitor ASINs, now we're allowing you to get deals fed to you. And we took Keepa Deals and made it better because Keepa Deals is how I did a lot of A2A and how I teach A2A. If you, like, that was a whole day associated with the challenge on Keepa Deals. And I think it's still really great. But what Keepa Deals sucks at is like parsing out private label, parsing out certain brands, bad reviews, stuff like that. And we've done all that. We take all that information and then we allow you to customize the exact feed that you want to see with these. And we do all the profit ROI calculations. So like if you want to see products that have three sellers that are 100,000 to rank that are profit $50, we will show you those exact products in real time as they pop up. And then if you missed out, oh, it's one click a button and you can monitor that product for restocks and we'll beat Keepa by 8 to 10 minutes. And so that is like the first core of that product. And then what's coming is there's going to be some retail tracking like Target, Walmart, Shopify. Like we do Hot Topic. So we do Target, Walmart, Hot Topic now. And then it'll be like all Shopify, Best Buy, like all the big ones. And then the one I'm most excited about is actually order tracking, because A2A can be really annoying, specifically for A2A order tracking, because some people have personal accounts and business accounts, and Amazon is notorious for like shipping things and having to get lost or never shipping them at all. Or maybe like you ordered it 3 to 6 months ago and you moved and you forgot to change the address. So now it's going to an old address. And so we're essentially taking all of your accounts into one place and giving you all the data to see like, what's actually in transit? Where was it delivered? What might be lost? Like making just super simple for you. That's as an A2A cool. buyer. So you don't have to worry about like, I'm sure I've lost tons of money with things that shipped, but then I forgot to like check on. And so that's where it is right now. And then I mentioned, yeah, we have like some newer, like more fun. Like I would really like to do some Chrome extensions. I've wanted to for a long time. I've never really had a developer that was trained in it, and I do now. And so to me, like Chrome extensions, like either a one time, like $49 for life, get access to it forever, or like $8 a month. That's kind of like where I am in pricing for those, because there is obviously costs associated, as you guys know, like servers and APIs and different things. But that's where we're headed. So we'll see. But they've kind of got a bit of the rundown now.
So looking through each of the software, what this could be, I'll give you the fork in the road question. Either the feature that you're most proud of or the feature that customers are not currently using and they should be using.
Well, I think what's interesting about ours is they're, I'm not going to say they're one dimensional, but they're all built around one feature, right? And you guys, you commented on it earlier, you build something and then you iterate. And that's what these are. Like these both existed in beta phases. They both have added a bunch of stuff for the user generated comments. But at its core, they do one thing, right? They either like A2A deals tracking or they do Storefront Stalking and they give you those leads. I think for Storefront Stalker, people 100% sleep on so we have like this interesting like export import feature and other things, and we've tried to build it as optimal towards like a reverse searching platform like TA or anyone else that you'd use. And I know for a fact there are multiple leads lists that exist in the market that use Storefront Stalker Pro and then just export all the ASINs to TA, reverse source them, and then just sell those leads. And I feel like if everyone just did that, they would have more success. And we also, this again, user generated people, the biggest complaint we had with Storefront Stalker Pro was, well, I don't know what a good store is. Like, how do I find a good seller to stock? And so we built in a store finder. So there's 20,000 stores that are loaded and you can sort them by reviews, number one category, number one brand. So if you want to find like a toy seller that's Lego, that's an arbitrage seller, we provide that store for you. And I don't know how many people are obviously using that. I don't think it's a lot. And I think that the number one reason people quit when we look is because they weren't really looking at, maybe they like pay for three stores looking at one. I'm like, well, okay, like, yeah, you're not gonna have a great experience if you're not using the product. And that's a little bit on us, and that's what we're trying to fix. Like, how do we make them more comfortable with using it? And then I would say for Flipalert, I'm most proud of the price drop deals section. Like, I think that's what I wanted the first tool 4 years ago to be. And it's taken 4 years to get here. But I'm like, I really, really wanted a product that I never had to open Keepa again for A2A. I was like, how do I, like, I love Keepa, but in my perfect world, I could build something that replaces it. And we're pretty much there. Like, I feel like I don't really need, I use Keepa for like off random, like little things that really wouldn't make sense at the moment to build into Flipalert, but maybe one day. But 90% of my buying now is through Flipalert. And so, like, I'm proud that I'm actually using the product as much as I am, and it's effective. So,
all right. So, Saul, a couple of terms you use there. So, you talked a little bit. So, in technical land, there's always an acronym for everything, right? So, you talked a little bit about APIs. So, what is an API, and how are you using them, and what does a customer need to care about in terms of how they're used?
Like, this is a question that I would be asking you. I don't know. Like, I feel like this is like the teacher giving like a pop quiz. I'm gonna solidify the answer, and it's not gonna be exactly the right answer. And then you can correct whatever I missed up.
The so working definition.
This is how I use APIs in my world, and then you can give the actual reason. So APIs are not every company or everything has an API. There are generally private APIs and public APIs. Usually a company will create an API, which is I'm going to call it an endpoint. I don't think it necessarily is, but it's a way that a product or service, like Walmart, for example, Walmart might create an API that you can tap into to pull product information. So it's a road that someone can connect to get a very specific piece of information. And they create a laundry list of different APIs. So there's like a highway, and they all have different roads, and you can connect each individual one depending on what information you need. And you can pull it in, and you kind of use that however you want. And some of them are private, and they're only supposed to be used internally. And then some are public, and you and me and other people can get access to them generally through some kind of application process or developer portal. Because most companies don't want this just like any person walking on the street, just like hopping across the API. And there are businesses entirely built on connecting APIs to other APIs like Zapier and other things. And they just like make life a little bit easier for people. So we use APIs for kind of just what I just said, right? So I think Keepa is great. And I think they are full of information, but I don't think that they let the user manipulate that information in the best way possible. And so what I want to do is I want to tap into Keepa's API, pull in information from Keepa, tap into Amazon's API, pull in information from Amazon, Walmart's API, wherever. I'm going to take all that information here, and then I'm going to show it to an end user in a way that I think makes more sense to them than just one of those. And it doesn't necessarily have to be combining APIs. I think sometimes it's honestly just using one API and manipulating it in a way that, like, we can use Keepa, for example. So as you talk about Keepa deal section, doesn't let you sort by review count. Like, you can't be like, I only want to see products that have three or more reviews. They don't let you do that. But each individual product that pops up on Keepa has all the information stored in it, and each of those can get access through the API. So we could, in theory, recreate that entire Keepa deal section using APIs from each individual products, and then allowing people to create a filter that then parses out all the ones that we don't care about based on whatever the end user wants. And that's like at its core, like the first part of Flipalert. Like we use Keepa API up top, and then we use a bunch of other stuff in the middle to help kind of create the end product. And there are just some like crazy big companies built on this concept of just like manipulating different APIs in different places. And we don't have to get into all that today, but that's my working definition of an API and how I use them.
That's perfect. That's the best way to describe it. I love asking the question to folks that say they're not technical, and they give the best answers to the technical question. So when you ask someone that's technical to give it, they'll give you, oh, it's an application programming interface, and this is what it does. But the way you broke that down is so perfect, right? And I think it's something that as the community continues to grow and start thinking about some of these areas, right? It's no different than on Twitter where you start to find your groups, right? You know, someone's really, really strong in one area of the business. You start to work with them and then you bring in your strength to the business. It's the same type of methodology within software, and especially with these APIs, is you're essentially partnering with another company or provider that has carved out their niche that they're really good at, that specific niche. And you're using that piece of it, tying it with yours, and the folks that put together, you know, the orchestration of all of those components generally have the products that have the most value. And the way that you've done that with the software that you own, I think is textbook on how to build products that people actually love and get value from as part of it. So,
you know what I suck at though? I'm working on it, and I actually have a call next week with someone who I think is very good at this. I do suck at the marketing side. Like I think I have a bit of like a small platform. I have a community, but like I'm really bad at talking about what I built. Like I really like the building and I enjoy talking about it when asked, but I don't do a great job of like, hey, come look at this thing and sign up for it and pay money for it. Which is like I have mixed feelings about. So I'm working on it because I think it's the money part that I get mixed feelings about. But we all like, again, it's not free. It's like, that's a sucky. Like none of this that we're building is free to build and free to run. And so like at some point you have to make money. But I do wish if I could do, yeah, that would be my goal for like 2025 is like actually getting more people even aware. Like they can say they hate it. I want to know why. But I think the problem is awareness. Like I don't think enough people are aware of the stuff that a lot of like us are doing. A lot of the small, like, there's like big giants. And then you have like a lot of the small ones, which are really, really good. They just don't have the awareness play yet.
Where do you see software going over the next couple of years? You talked a little bit about Zapier. There's some pretty interesting things coming, whether that's in AI or no code space. Has that been any area that you've been starting to look into as you're starting to build out your portfolio?
I'm a big no code fan. I haven't done much in the Amazon space for it. So for our D2C business, we built a no-code tool 2 years ago. And it's like a tool / video platform. I don't know exactly what to call it, but it was probably one of the more fun projects to build. Like that was, I'm not a developer as we talked about, but like, oh, I could whip up a mean Zapier flow. And, that was so much fun to build. And so we like did Zapier and we did Memberflow. We run, Webflow. And we like that generates, it doesn't generate a lot of money, but it's like $15,000 or $20,000 a year. Just like I haven't touched it in 2 years. And so those things are really fun. I think right now in the no code space in Amazon, I think you have some interesting stuff going on, like Neil. I don't know if you guys have talked to Neil yet. It was your first podcast. It was his first podcast. He was very excited. So I enjoy talking to Neil quite a bit, and he's doing some cool stuff, right? Like I think the email parsing stuff, which is something that I've done for my buy sheets, and like those kind of tools are really big and will become bigger. I think people are still really confused. And I think part of it is because it's still something that people have to build themselves. Like, there's not like an easy one click option yet, but it doesn't have to be super technical. Like whoever decides to build that could just certainly build it off of Zapier and Bubble and whatever else they want to use to get there. So I don't know. I imagine we're going to see a lot more small team projects. People are going to realize they don't need to go outsource and spend $100 an hour on a developer. And they can build a lot of interesting stuff with AI and a little bit of elbow grease. I remember we came out with, we didn't really talk about it. We have kind of an A2A scanner in the buy box that we launched about 4 years ago, which is a very, very light version of FlipAlert, but it's just like Discord based. And I remember we paid for that. And now there's like so many groups have that and they just built it themselves. And it might not look quite as pretty. Like, it might not have like all the bells and whistles, but at its core, like, they understand conceptually how to do it, and they just did it with ChatGPT, and that's awesome. Yeah. So I imagine we're gonna, yeah, I think that the people that are willing to be flexible, the willingness of people to partner and be open-minded, are going to continue to find success. And the people that have spent a lot of money and time building something, and then an 18-year-old kid comes along and like builds something similar, and they get really angry about that, are going to have a harder time, because I think this is just the beginning of that.
Mm-hmm. So one thing you touched on that we haven't really talked about would be the D2C company that you help run and own. You want to touch a little bit on that for the audience? And then I'm interested to know, has that helped you become a better Amazon seller running with that?
We're taking the audience on a ride tonight, huh?
We're getting it.
Yeah. So it's about 80% D2C, about 20% B2B. And for those that are listening, it's essentially D2C is FBM. So like, we ship directly to our customers through Shopify, and then B2B, we're selling to wholesalers, distributors, or retailers. And that's been same thing as Amazon. Like, so that's when I started that. That was 2019, I think. I think it was like the tail end of 2019 or early 2020. It was an existing company, and I'll be like, I'm usually very upfront about it. Met the founder. They were doing maybe like $30,000 a month, and they wanted to get into Amazon. And if she's listening, she'll hear. I don't want this news to her. I said, yeah, I could do that for you. And I had no idea what I was doing. which is kind of how my life usually goes. I mean, you say yes to things and figure it out as you go. I figured it out. I mean, we got brand registered, we got our product Amazon, like, we made the listing, like, I learned a whole bunch of stuff. And through that relationship, I just kind of kept getting more. I did it all for free. I was like essentially volunteering my time, and fast forward many years, and she made me co-founder, and she gave me a bunch of equity, and like, that's like what I do bulk of my day now, is helping her run that company. And it is wild. Like, I feel like it has certainly helped Amazon. It's also maybe hurt it a little bit, just in like, I don't have the time I once did. Like, we talked about like the death piles I have in my warehouse. So like, there are certain things that like, Amazon is not number one anymore on my priority list. And prep centers certainly help if I'm trying to like still do stuff. But, you know, managing an entirely remote team, I managed a bunch of people in my previous career all in person. So going remote was interesting. And that has really helped me. And now, like, talk about the developers, like, I can work with people now remote on Amazon. I mean, my entire buy box staff, all my developers, everyone's remote. And it feels very easy now because I had that transition period. I am the warehouse. So like, my warehouse is split between Amazon and Walmart, but also all of our product for D2C. So like, I manage all of that. And so all of the like shipping relationships, carriers, importing from China, all of like cross-country like deliveries, pallets, like, I do all of that. And I didn't know anything about that 5 years ago. And so like, I'm primed for a PL product. Like, I am so ready at some point, because I know all the people now. And so I do think that it's a true startup, and we've grown from $30,000 to about $200,000 a month. And we're continuing to grow. And I think that that startup culture and the flexibility that's required there, and it's like 60% word of mouth. And the founder is phenomenal at networking and just like getting people to refer the product, has helped me so much. Like, I tweet about, but like, if you, it's just kind of asking, like, I feel like half the things that have happened in that business is because you just kind of asked to be a part of something that seemed crazy at the time. And then someone's just like, yeah. And I realize that now. I'm certainly not much of a somebody in the space, but I think there are people that just start Amazon that like look at our Twitter numbers, they look at whatever, and they're like, oh, these people. And like, I'll get DMs and they'll ask questions that I wish I was comfortable asking when I first started. And like, I'm more than happy to say yes. And that like continues up the line. I mean, it's half the reason that like we partnered with Chris Grant and he's a partner of the Buy Box now, because like, I didn't think that was possible 5 years ago. But you're like, I've learned it. You ask questions, you figure it out as you go. And then, yeah, I'm excited for like the private label and the shipping stuff is going to be interesting when it gets there. But I'm more than happy to talk like specifics if there's any, but at its core, like, yeah, we ship, 2,000 ish packages a month. We have 7 SKUs. We manufacture most of them ourselves. We have trademarks. We have intellectual property. We have the patents. So like that process was really interesting and fun. We've raised capital. So we raised a bit of money at an $8 million valuation. So we had to go through and like pitch to all of like the people that you like, the VC-ish people. And like that was, getting in nitty gritty with finances was not something that I had done prior to my Amazon business, but I really understand the process now having to go through it here. So it's given me a lot of perspective. I think it's really easy to get lost in the sauce. And I've said this, I think, in the last podcast I was on with you guys. I think the Amazon community is awesome, but I think it's important to recognize that it is small. And there is a lot of things you can learn from a lot of people that don't sell on Amazon that will help you in your Amazon journey. And it's okay. Like, I think sometimes people just need permission. Like, it's okay to be interested in other non-Amazon related businesses. And it's okay to talk to those people and learn from those people. And you'll be able to bring so much into what you do as a business owner, because at the core, that's what we are. We're not just Amazon sellers, we're business owners. And so that it's easy to forget that. And I just want to make sure, like, if I've learned nothing, it's I'm a small potato in the big basket of fries. And I like meeting all these really big people. It helps me a lot.
Well, so you hit on really the reason for asking, which is like, if you get into Amazon to start selling on Amazon, say you're starting RA or OA and it's not your gig, there are different avenues that you can go that may be more interest. And so pivoting is not the end of the world. Like if you wanted to go help someone, a D2C, get into Amazon, that might be something that's more up your alley. Go do it. Like, you don't have to stay in one lane forever. You can kind of go and pivot and learn and leverage the learnings that you maybe found in RA and OA and leverage them in a different way. Like, you don't have to.
Oh, yeah.
That's why.
You're a product analyst as an Amazon buyer. I mean, like, yeah. you know products. I mean, I would be surprised if you do Amazon for a year or more. You could probably do pretty well in any like major retailer's corporate setting. Like if someone wanted to hire you at Mattel, like you probably have a like pretty good idea of how to read a market after looking at a million Keepa charts.
True. 100%. So before we wrap up, I like to just kind of give the floor to whatever guests we have on. If there's anything that's on your mind you want to talk about before we wrap, I kind of give the floor. Is there anything that's going on in Saul's brain recently that you wanted to riff on a little bit?
I feel like most of this podcast has been just incoherent thoughts from Saul's brain.
That's perfect.
No, I mean, I think we talked about a lot of things, and I almost think we can break this up into parts. Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed. I talked, and you guys really nailed the message away from what I was saying. We talked about a little like the pre-show, and we don't have to harp on it here. But I do think they're, again, also in the Amazon space, I've seen a lot of people get really angry recently, and I will say nothing's new to me in Amazon. I've been in the 8 years, I might have been on Twitter for 8 years, but Facebook's the same thing. Everything goes like this. If you're listening to me, you can't see, I'm making a wave pattern with my hand. Like everything literally like happens. And then 2 years later it happens again. And we're kind of currently on the wave of like, you should be angry that people are teaching other people how to do Amazon. And I never get frustrated or mad at anyone. I'd like to think I don't have any enemies. But I'm only here because someone taught me. And I paid for a Facebook group. It was $20 a month. And I still talk to that guy. Like, he's awesome. And he believed in me, and he taught me so much of the fundamentals and the basics. Obviously, he didn't hand hold me to the store and pick out the thing to buy, but I probably wouldn't have felt comfortable taking it as far as I did if I hadn't learned from him. And so, to, you know, if I'm going to turn around and teach other people, like, I don't look at it as creating competition. I look at it as, like, he changed my life. I'm like, I almost need to repay that forward. And I think a lot of other people feel the same. I imagine, like, you guys have helped a ton of people, and you were helped by other people, and it's the same thing. And so, yeah, I would, like, I don't think, long story, there's that. And then the second part is, like, I don't think people that get into helping people on Amazon or do anything else are doing it for the money. And I can confidently say that we have 10 staff members. Like, I mean, me included, but we have 10 staff members in the bylaws. 9 of the 10 do over $1 million a year. Many do more, like, you know, more than just one. The money that they get from, like, me, like, to pay them, because I pay them what I can afford, it's pittance. It's like a day's profit selling. And they put so much time in live calls and and there's nothing there. Like, literally the only thing they're getting from this is the, like, internal, like, feeling of helping others. And so I think it's important also, like, there are lots of people that do this and teach and whatever because they just want to, and not necessarily to get rich. There are certain people that have gotten rich, and, like, great too. Like, that's fine. But I don't like when we, like, stereotype, I guess, of, like, oh, you creating an education product, you're doing something because you want to go retire in your Lamborghini and, like, never sell again. Yeah, man, I'd say in the pre-show, like, we talked about all those tech projects. The Buy Box, you know, has been around for 5 years. We have hundreds of members. All those things combined, it's, yeah, I pay myself under $20,000 a year from all of that. And people are like, well, where's the money go? I'm like, well, it goes to all the tech projects. I mean, it goes to tech, it goes to staff. It goes other places. I would be remiss if I said I didn't think about it occasionally. I'm like, what am I, like, is this make sense for me to do still with all my time? But then, like, it's hard to stop. Like, you get addicted to, like, seeing people win. So that's it. I just don't like the generalized hate. I don't like hate in general, but I think it's okay to question what people are saying. Like, if someone's like, oh, buy my course, I've done $100 million. Well, like, cool. Can we validate that in some way? Like, yeah. Let's talk about that a little bit. But otherwise, like, I don't think the, like, first gear that people should be in is, like, immediately sus. Like, oh, they're scammy or they're just trying to get rich. Like, I think there's lots of really good people out there in the world. And maybe I'm looking through rose colored glasses, but, like, a lot of really shitty things have happened to me in life. And I think a lot of it puts you in perspective. There's more good people than bad. And so that would be it. I hope that this phase ends at some point, which I'm sure it will. I don't really get personal hate. I guess if you really want to hate me, you can. But yeah, it's, that's it. I see that a little bit more recently. So I wanted to come out. I don't know how many people that run paid Discords talk about how much they make. But I'm happy to admit it's probably a lot less than you thought. and that's okay with me.
Well, I'll have to show you how the mute button works on Twitter, because I haven't seen any of it.
I really don't mute many people, because, again, what I did do, I deleted Twitter on my phone, like, 6 weeks ago.
Oh, smart, yeah.
And so the only way I can go on Twitter is if I go on, like, Safari or Chrome and log in. It's, like, severely cut down my Twitter time.
Yeah.
Like, I only go on now when I have an idea that I want to express, or, like, I'm checking a message. Yeah. And that's been awesome. Because I think Twitter's really great. I think it's a really cool tool. And I mentioned I met a bunch of people. I mean, you guys, the developers. But too much Twitter can also hurt your brain. And so like, there's a line.
Well, it's funny though. Like when you're starting on Twitter, like you're on it all the time. But now if like I need something from Saul, I just text you and I don't go to Twitter anymore. Like it's changed a little bit over time.
Yeah. It's, I mean, that's the beauty too. Like you, in the word text, most people are not comfortable. Like even it's like, I actually wasn't super comfortable getting my phone number on Twitter for a long time. You know who changed my perspective on giving my phone number out? Shout out Joe Hart. Because I talked to Joe and he was just like, oh, here's my number, text me. And I was like, whoa. I was like, you don't know me. Like, what are you doing? Give me your number. And so like, I talked to Joe and I was like, okay, that's cool. And then I just was like, I don't know why I was afraid of this. And so I just, give my number out now more freely. And I think you have to guard it a little bit, but yeah, I think it's pretty cool that I don't know why. I think there's like the anon area. Like you don't really know who's behind the account. Like Facebook, I was more comfortable because like everyone's name is like plastered there. Sometimes on Twitter, you don't exactly know. But yeah, I think if you're young and you're comfortable and giving out like contact information outside of the app, you're definitely going to have an easier time forming relationships.
100%. Yeah, it's been quite the journey, not only in Twitter, but just this podcast in general. We've gone everywhere, which I do. I think there's a lot of value in here. But Saul, thank you for coming on. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
But for anybody that's listening in, go drop Saul a follow at Saul Sells Stuff, and we will catch you in the next episode.